journée historique. La France mobilisée dans la rue comme jamais elle ne l'a été, pas même lors de la libération de 1945.
More than a million people, including world leaders who locked arms, marched in the broad boulevards of Paris on Sunday in outrage and solidarity against the wave of terrorism that hit the French capital and its suburbs. In this second hour of midday, a look at the last 6 days in Paris with Nicole Dombrowski-Risser, a historian and French scholar, and Fahim Younis, Muslim-American commentator. Terror and religious extremism, free speech, and Western society. Your thoughts and observations are welcome as well. Open phone lines during the next hour of midday after the news.
1,5 million selon les organisateurs, l'ensemble des grandes artères entourant les places de la République et de la Nation ont été noyées par une foule pacifique et bon enfant.
And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour here, Dan Rodericks. Thanking you for joining us again. 410-662-8780 is the phone number for live talk on Midday. We have open phone lines to talk about the events in France of the last 6 days, including yesterday's massive demonstration in the streets of Paris. Please give us a ring. This is the first time we've had open phone lines on the subject of the terrorist attacks last Wednesday in Paris and what's happened since then. So much has happened since then, and we welcome your comments again at our local phone number, 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. If you've caught us on Twitter, you know we're doing this show. You can reach us online through wypr.org or send us an email with your comments as well. That's midday at wypr.org. I want to welcome back to the show Fahim Younis. Fahim Younis is the Baltimore president of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community. He's a senior fellow at the Hofberger Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. We first met him a few years ago after he established this Muslim-American website called Muslim American, MuslimAmerican.com, right?
That's correct.
Nice to have you back with us.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Fahim was with us briefly on Friday to talk a little bit about the events in France, but he has frequently commented on faith, culture, politics, and the long, some would say, endless war on terror. So it's nice to have you back with us to talk for the next hour about this.
Thank you for having me.
And I also want to welcome to Midday today Nicole Dombrowski-Risser. Nicole Dombrowski-Risser is a professor of history at Towson University with research interests in the social and cultural history of France and Europe. She's the author of France Under Fire, German Invasion, Civilian Flight, and Family Survival During World War II. That was published a couple of years ago by Cambridge University Press. She also served some years ago as editor of Women and War in the 20th Century, Enlisted With or Without Consent, was the title of that book from 2004. Nice to have you with us, Nicole Dombrowski-Risser.
Thank you, Dan. It's nice to be here.
You've been paying very close attention to this because of your interest in France. And I just, since this is the first time we've had a chance to talk about all of this since the attack at Charlie Hebdo. How do you pronounce it, by the way?
Charlie Hebdo.
Charlie Hebdo, yeah. Last Wednesday. Just your thoughts about the attack, about all that's happened since then. Please take your time.
Okay. Well, yesterday, I think, was dramatic. Sunday.
Certainly was.
40 heads of state and their representatives marched hand-in-hand with François Hollande, including Mahmoud Abbas on one side and Netanyahu on the other. Reports of 1.3 million people in Paris and then 3 million throughout the country under the banner Je suis Charlie, I am Charlie, in solidarity with the journalists and the cartoonists who were slain in Paris, and of course then the victims at the Jewish grocery store and the police officers who were also slain. So the outpouring comes after 4 days of intense TV, radio, and international coverage of this terrorist event that unfolded before our eyes, in which these two brothers, Saïd and Sharif Kouachi, both French-born, grew up essentially in the suburbs, were the sons of Algerian immigrants to France lost their parents when they were very young and were put as orphans into the care of foster care, and really seemed to have lost their way. They were in Corrèze, came back to Paris, and began a life of delinquency and militantism, and they tried to avenge the prophet on Wednesday last week. They stormed into the protected journalistic offices in Paris in the 11th arrondissement. They had a Kalashnikov and they had a another type of semi-automatic weapon. They pushed past a mail delivery person and a woman. They gunned their way into the protected offices of Charlie Hebdo, which were it's a small magazine. I would compare it in some ways to the Rolling Stone. It came out of the 1960s. These were young guys who were in the streets of Paris in 1968 protesting against Charles de Gaulle and against, you know, the bourgeoisie. And they came out of a communist background, some of them. Walensky also wrote for L'Humanité and Charlie Charbonnier, Stéphane Charbonnier, who is Charbou, who designed the provocative cartoon. He was the youngest, really, of this group of old 1968ers who were just rabble-rousers and irreverent.
I have a question before you go on with the recounting these events first. Charlie Hebdo, so Hebdo. You say, sort of reminds you of Rolling Stone. Some might say, with the emphasis on cartoons, not may not see that comparison. So I wondered about the satirical, some describe it as a newspaper, some a magazine. What has it been its role in society? What are your observations about it over the years in French society?
Yeah, well, it's kind of on the margins in some regard. It's got 10,000 circulation. It is sold in the kiosks around Paris and around the country for €3. And it's really seen as way out there, unreformed. It's not mainstream, and yet these are some of the hero cartoonists of this generation of 68ers. And I think of, you know, Rolling Stones coming out of Berkeley and that kind of movement in the 1960s. Okay. And it became more, you know, mainstream later.
But some people look at these cartoons, which I hadn't seen them before the terror attack and this massacre that occurred in the Charlie Hebdo offices, and say, wow, these are really ugly and provocative and mean. And, you know, yes, free speech and expression, we're all for that. I mean, there's more and more commentary that I've seen the last few days, people saying, je ne suis pas Charlie. That's not something that I would support. And even people have said that they would kind of goaded these terrorists into acting. I know you've heard this.
I certainly have, and I know I have friends who have that persuasion of thinking. I think the Je suis Charlie is not that I am for this kind of cartooning. It is that I am against this kind of terroristic violence. And so I think that we can't conflate the two. But in terms of the history of the paper, they reprinted the Danish cartoons in 2006, and that was the initial kind of provocation. And then in 2010, they printed their own depiction of the prophet, which was what we would all consider tasteless and unnecessary, and possibly provocation. Their right to do so is deeply anchored in French historical political cartooning and secular movements that defined the Republic at its core. And when François Hollande got on to make the speech on Wednesday, he said, the Republic has been attacked. It has been attacked in its heart in a newspaper. And this idea that the freedom of press is sacred is certainly not the policy of France. It is not the policy of the French Republic, and it has not been the policy of the French state. And yet it has emerged as a kind of image against extremism. And I think that
it's not the policy. You mean the government is attempts to censor the press in some way?
The French government under several regimes has attempted to censor the press. The press is censored. It certainly cannot print anti-Holocaust denials. It can't print. There is protected speech in France. The press is limited in how much English it can publish and how much English can be spoken on the airwaves. So the press is definitely monitored. The press is owned by the state. There are private channels, but the press is a state agency.
Fahim, I want to bring you in here on this point of the because we touched on it on Friday about blasphemy and the je ne suis pas Charlie that I've heard is that, as I described, people who just can't seem to support this kind of a depiction of sacred figures, Christian or Muslim or whatever.
And I appreciate you going beyond the platitudes, Dan, and really understanding the nuances of this issue. I'll start by saying that I represent the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, and we have a proud tradition for over a century in our community that we love the Prophet dearly, but we will give our life for his honor. We will never dare take anyone's life. What I mean by that is, in Pakistan, our community is persecuted for this reason, and we are even considered non-Muslims by some, and nearly 200 Ahmadi Muslims have been butchered because of our love for Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Yet, we've never engaged in a single act of extremism. So that is the position which we believe is the core Islamic position. So first of all, I completely agree with Nicole and many of those French protesters. There should never be a reason to kill anyone and not even threaten people. But then the larger question is it really freedom of expression? And what do we do with that? Because like you've already touched upon it, not in just France, but in US, in Europe, we don't mock the Holocaust. We don't use an N-word. We don't use homophobic slurs. I can go on and on. And they are not regulated by penal codes. They're regulated by social codes. And that is all. You know, as a Muslim, I'm not asking for special treatment when I say don't print these cartoons. I'm asking for equal treatment. That why is it any different than what we see with many other communities? And that's not to say that Islam or somehow the Muslim figures should be above any criticism. Absolutely, you should talk about all those criticisms in a sane, decent academic fashion. But lampooning my beloved over and over again, I don't consider that to be hustling with a marketplace of ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not my view there.
So there would be, we presume, people in France who would not be surprised, or in Europe in general, or anywhere, who might not be surprised that these acts occurred.
Right.
Given this and the target.
And in many cases, they were expected. And so, for example, the girlfriend of Stephen Charbonnier, Jeannette Bougrabe, she was on French television this week blaming the government for knowing every day that he received death threats, that he was not adequately protected, that the journal was not adequately protected, and she has called for them to be placed in the Pantheon as martyrs to the nation and to the Republic. And there has been a lot of outcry against that. Not outcry. I think that in this moment there is no outcry. There is a lot of unity, and there are quiet murmurings that, well, maybe that's not the case. In 2012, the French government asked the newspaper to please stop printing these characterizations of the Prophet and to tone down their rhetoric. And the newspaper was burned down in 2011. They had to take their refuge in offices in La Liberté. And so they have stood really firmly. And are they supported by a majority of French people? I don't think we can know that yet. Certainly the most vocal majority of people who are against violent repression for freedom of speech spoke out yesterday and in the streets of Paris. But now on the margins, you have somebody like the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen, Marine Le Pen, who is on the far right, who's taking 30% of the vote, saying we shouldn't have immigrants, we should have a pure French society, we shouldn't tolerate assimilation, much less immigration. And so that strengthens her position.
Many French Muslims probably today wonder, what now? What happens to us now? And there's some history here that we should go over after we take this break. Many American Muslim Americans had the same question after 9/11. We're going to take some calls. We'll open the phone lines after this short break. 410-662-8780 as we reflect on the events of the last 6 days in France, including yesterday's massive demonstration in the streets of Paris. Je suis Charlie. Do you agree with that? Or are you Je ne suis pas, Charlie. Where are you on this? And more conversation when we get back. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here, joined this hour by Nicole Dombrowski-Risser, professor of history at Towson University and a French scholar, and Fahim Yunus, president of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community here in the Baltimore area, and who's a frequent commentator on Muslim American affairs, faith, culture, politics, and the war on terror. A question from Kevin in Hagerstown. What part of the Quran do jihadis cite as their reason for murder in the name of Muhammad?
Peace be upon him. I've been looking for that part, Dan, for the past 20 years. I haven't found it. What I have found is verse 141, chapter 4, where God in Quran over and over again, the prophets are referred to as the signs of God, not just Prophet Muhammad, but Jesus, Moses, and many, many others. The verse clearly says, when you hear the signs of Allah being denied and mocked at, sit not with them until they engage in a talk other than that. That is clearly in the Quran. So when you see that mockery, you simply move away, you walk away, you walk out. That is the Quranic reference, but I have not found a single verse, and that is why we continue to challenge the fringe extreme this group within Muslims who are proponents of blasphemy laws from Algeria to Pakistan, from Morocco to Indonesia, and I believe that is the root cause of this terrorism. Since past 40 years, we have enforced these blasphemy laws, and a lot of time Christians and Hindus and Muslim minorities are at the receiving end of these laws. They are abusive. They create intolerant, discriminatory societies. And they're done under the legal cover, their penal codes, their punishments, from 3 years to death penalty. And that is a political angle. There is nothing in Quran. And final point, there are a handful of cases, single digits, during the life of the Prophet who were executed. But they were not executed because of blasphemy. They were executed for treason against the state. And even today, the punishment for treason in the United States is also death penalty. So some of these clergies conflate those two issues.
I noticed a quote in the press from Hassan Nasrallah, who's the leader of Hezbollah, referring to takfiris,
yes,
or wannabe Muslims.
That's right.
He says, the behavior of some of the terrorist and takfiri groups that attribute themselves to Islam through their words and actions and their reprehensible and ugly and violent and inhuman and brutal practices have insulted the messenger of Allah and the religion of Allah and the prophets and the book of Allah and the nation of the Muslims more than his enemies insulted him.
Completely agreed with that quote.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here if you'd like to join us. One more question for Nicole. Before we take our first call. So Muslims in France have had taken some heat over the years. There have been controversies. There have been issues with increased immigration of Muslims in France, not just in Paris, but in rural areas too. So what now, someone might ask? And is it possible to gauge how much of the demonstration and outrage we're hearing is backlash against Muslims in France?
Well, I think that the unity rally, Rally for the Republic yesterday, was very well marked by Islamic Muslim participation. And there were certainly people within the Muslim community. The chief imam of Paris and the chief rabbi of the big synagogue, La Grande Synagogue, came to bed together in a unity prayer ceremony at the Porte de Vincennes where the Jewish victims were. But for Many, you know, this is a generational divide in France where first generation, maybe they came in the 1950s, 1960s after the Algerian War, wanted to assimilate to French culture and wanted to just kind of be secular or privately religious. And it's their children who are finding that they weren't absorbed into French society, that they started going to, they wanted to search for a Muslim identity. And the more that the French state would repress with laws against wearing the veil outlawing the burqa, as was done, I think that was in 2009. So when these laws, that radicalized that generation in certain kinds of really alienating ways. And so we look at, for example, some of the comments in the northern cities of Paris where children were asked to observe a moment of silence, and that was immediately on January 8th, the day after the first attacks. And teachers expressed on Facebook that they couldn't get their children to be quiet during that moment of silence, that some children were saying that the reporters the journalists, should have expected this kind of response. And so there's, I would say, a divided generational opinion. What mark will this have on this young generation of Muslim children in France? I think the official word from all the mosques that, were shown on French TV over the week was one of solidarity with the Republic. This isn't the kind of Islam that we bring to France. And so the other point I wanted to make is that the French president was very specific in his speech, in his rally for unity, and his condemnation of the terrorists. He never once used the word Islam. He never once used the word Muslim. He never mentioned the Quran. He said barbarism. These are barbarians, and we will fight barbarians. And so he is very much trying to maintain the political discourse as a discourse against extremism, but against barbarianism, and not even use the word Islam or Muslim. Not the same for his rival, Marine Le Pen.
I want to hear a little bit more about her during this hour, too. One thing I noticed yesterday was this, it was impossible not to see it, is this massive outpouring of outrage, solidarity against terrorism in the streets of Paris. What did you say? 1.3 million, I think, was the estimate of people.
Yeah.
It's just extraordinary to me. I know they have the Grand Boulevard over there. Mm-hmm. So we do in this country, too. We could fill Washington with people in those kind of numbers. We did, I think, when Barack Obama was inaugurated the first time. But I wonder, after 9/11, was there ever such an outpouring of American citizens into the streets, locking arms, marching through the streets, saying, no more, we won't have this, this won't happen again? I know the nation was in grief and mourning, but so was France after this incident. But we didn't take to the streets in this way after 9/11. I'm just so amazed by it. Maybe it's in the European tradition to fill the streets, to people who come out and not just tweet and post on Facebook, but actually meet face to face in the streets. That's still very much a part of European life, and certainly in France.
Well, you'll remember the government shut down much of the United States in the aftermath of the terrorist attack as well. So that was, I think, the fear factor. The response of our government was much different than the French response, in which François Hollande called for this march.
Right, right.
And called for people to march. One of the protesters
No one called for us to go to the streets for this reason at that time.
You were asked to go shopping.
By that. Well, I remember President Bush saying, if you want to help America, get on with your lives. And I think he did say go shopping, become a consumer. Phil's been holding. Phil's in Hamden. Thank you for holding, Phil. We'll take your comments now. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good afternoon. Yes, hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead, Phil.
Oh, hi. Yes, I'm very sad to hear about the events of Paris this last week, a city I love very much, and I've been there three times in my life. And also, in 1972, I was in another major European city when one of the most famous terrorist acts of all time took place. I had tickets for the last several days of the great Olympic Games in Munich, Germany. And we arrived on the very day that the 11 Israeli athletes were murdered. And, it was quite a shock, of course. And, being in the city that already had the world media focus because of something wonderful that had been happening, the great Olympic Games, and then this terribly sad thing occurred. And so, many of these terrorist incidents over the years since, the Boston Marathon bombing 2 years ago, and that touched me deeply because I used to run the Boston Marathon back in the 1970s. And, again, Paris, a city I've been to, and, I'm just so sad to hear about this, but I'm very touched by the outpouring of so many people who came out, the last day or two to march. It really is wonderful, and I just wish this madness could stop somehow, but I guess that's going to take a very long time. But
yeah, this madness.
Appreciate
Thank you. Yeah, appreciate your comments, Phil. Yeah, how does it stop? You propose a solution that's sort of internal to the world of Islam. The rest of us are out here just wondering, what can we do to make this stop, if anything?
There is some degree of cognitive dissonance on both sides. I've already talked about those Muslims who will condemn these attacks, yet they will support blasphemy laws. To me, that is a cognitive dissonance. You can't have it both ways. Similarly, here in the West, we have a tendency to define what was the worst terror attack based on our perceptions. We have never defined, how do you define that? Is it based on civilian deaths? Is it how many people perished? How many women became widows and how many children were orphaned? If that's the way we're going to define it, then you start from Afghanistan, I'll take you to Gaza. And in between, I'll show you a lot of what those people will define as terrorism. We may continue to say this is collateral damage. We may continue to say, no, we were not hunting for those children. They, human shields and whatnot. But when we do that over and over and over again, at some stage, we lose that argument because it comes across as we have a mental calculation. And one of the army generals came on New York Times and he said, for every high-level target in Pakistan drone attacks, we kill, there are 50 civilians perished. So there is a 1 to 50 ratio, and somebody in a higher echelon has agreed that, okay, that's a big enough or a small enough risk for us to take. So I think it's important for us to, that's the cognitive dissonance on our side, that how do we define terrorism and which one is the worst terror attack? What is that criteria?
You could have been on the ground in Baghdad.
Absolutely.
In Gaza.
That's right.
In Fallujah, and seen the war on terror, which came over in, American fighters and American troops, and seen all that as terror.
Exactly.
Right?
And that's exactly what my point is. Go walk the streets of Baghdad, and these are people as well. When they listen to us, crying or 3 million people getting, I'm not trying to minimize that by any means. All I'm saying is we need to face, these are the difficult conversations and somebody has to start them.
One other thing I noticed in the last week, the French reacting to this just barbaric act of murder, a massacre in a newspaper office. In this country, had that happened in this country, it would have been a major news story. But it would have been one in a long line of mass shootings that have occurred in this country. And I'm not saying we would just be casual about it. It certainly would be news. But it's more common in the United States. Of course, if it's a terrorist act, if someone is carrying out a terrorist act in the name of, Allah or something like that, maybe that makes it different. But we've had so many shootings like this. This is not something that happens in French society.
Yeah, I think this is part of the shock in Paris, is that there is much more regulation of arms in Europe and certainly in France. Access to these kinds of weapons is much more highly regulated. And certainly we have multiple massacres in this country on a regular basis because of unregulation of guns in my mind. And what you saw in Paris, I think, was a real wake-up, and that's part of the solidarity, is that the French feel like they've done the right thing since really 9/11, that they've been supportive of the United States, but they've been very careful to, not entangle themselves too much in the Iraq war because they do have 4.7 million Muslims living in their country. They are an old colonial power within the Middle East, and so they definitely feel very much like culturally they are a little bit more invested in the Arab world and that they have tried to assimilate and also foster dialogue between Israel and Palestine and not taken what they see as a kind of American blindness on the part of Israel. And that's probably, you know, a little bit why Barack Obama and Joe Biden didn't show up among the, you know, coterie of nations.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
this is really, this is exceptional for Parisians. And they are not used to this kind of violence.
Let's take another call. Mike in Hunt Valley, you're on Midday. Go right ahead with your comments, please.
Yes, good afternoon. I was just calling to say that it seems to me that this is really a more of a clash of civilizations. You know, the concepts of freedom of speech and assembly and, you know, égalité, fraternité, and liberté, these are not concepts that are known in the Muslim world. Maybe fraternité, perhaps, because of the ummah and the brotherhood of Muslims. But the reality is that these are not notions that are widespread in the Muslim world. From Morocco to Indonesia, it's simply not. If you look at the constitution of Iran, for example, you know, it will say that Iranians have freedom of speech within the context of Islam. Women will have equal rights within the context of Islam. I urge your listeners to look up the Iranian constitution of 1979, and you'll get a real idea of where the power lies in most Muslim countries where, you know, were there not military dictatorships. You know, these are the imams and the ayatollahs really would control in just virtually every country with the exception possibly of Malaysia and Indonesia. So these are very, very different cultures. And I think this is going to unfortunately play out in a very horrible scene in Europe in the next few generations. Now, with regard to the radicalization of French Muslims, because they women have been barred from wearing niqab or burqa or chadors, this is not true. The women wear them in the Netherlands and in Germany, in Spain, and there are also terrorist attacks there. So I think it's really more or less just part of this wider clash of civilizations.
All right, thank you, Mike.
I would disagree with that because, give you a little sampler, Leviticus 26:14. Anyone who blasphemes the name of the Lord is to be put to death, and the whole house has to be stoned.
Are you countering that with Leviticus?
I'm just coming to talk about this civilization that we continue to somehow profess that the Judeo-Christian values are very different. I do not believe it has to do anything with any specific faith. Like the French philosopher Voltaire said that... Anyway, I'll come back to that later. But I just slipped my mind.
Well, you can point to a number of countries where there are... oligarchy, dictatorship, theocracy, where you know, the idea of a free press is foreign. It doesn't mean that regular people, normal people, don't accept the idea.
But what I'm saying is that Islam has a 1,400 years long history. When you try to, you know, when the argument goes that Islam is somehow inherently to be blamed for these things, I think that's an oversimplistic argument, because if you look at the first 1,370 years, you don't see any such violence. You don't see clashes. Now, what we have done is in the past 50 years, these are political situations. We have created a very difficult situation in that part of the world. We have implanted dictators. Then we talk about free speech on one end. And those dictators have really ruined these societies. When we are leaving Afghanistan now, 50% of Afghanistan's population is under the age of 15, 1-5. We're not leaving them with schools. We're leaving them on the street. And what are they going to grow up to? You know, they're going to become doctors and engineers? No, they're going to become terrorists and extremists because life is not worth living for them. So my point really is what you're seeing is a recent political phenomenon. Are they using religion as a cover? Absolutely. Should they be rooted out? Absolutely. And that is what the mission of Ahmadiyya Muslim community is.
Fahim Yunus is Baltimore president of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. He's also a blogger and a writer as a Muslim American or MuslimAmerican.com. And Nicole Dombrowski-Risser is with us, professor of history at Towson University with scholarship in France and Europe. A short break. We'll come back and take some more calls. And I have several emails to read. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Am I right? Sometimes I forget the phone number, 410-662-8780, and the email address is midday@wypr.org. comment from Sean in Timonium, who says, in regards to an individual's religious beliefs and freedom of speech, no one is obligated to respect another's beliefs. We are obligated to respect another's right to believe whatever they choose. Religious beliefs are thoughts held by an individual or group, and in public discourse, they deserve no special protection denied to any other system of thought. No group should be able to claim some kind of special protection for their beliefs. Maybe more importantly, there can't be a but statement surrounding freedom of speech. If we are willing to make freedom of speech conditional, we are willing to erode the very fabric of our democracy. Thanks for your comment, Sean. Email address from Midday again, midday@wypr.org. And there was an email here from Tom I wanted to read, who says, I have not been able to declare Je suis Charlie because I completely disavow the kind of stick-in-the-eye, gasoline-on-the-fire, faith-baiting style of Charlie Hebdo, some of which would be decried as hate speech if it were published in the United States. Yes, I am outraged by terrorism and the murder of civilians, and I believe in and practice free speech. But je ne suis pas Charlie. Rather than identifying with Charlie Hebdo, I would rather march to honor the masses of unnamed, unpublished people in the Mideast and Africa who have been murdered and abused in the name of religion. Many of them, probably the majority, were Muslims who didn't belong or wouldn't bow to the fascist ideology being promoted by the jihadist movement. Thank you, Tom. Back to the phone lines. Jack in Baltimore, thank you for holding. Please go ahead with your comments.
Hi, I just wanted to pick up on something that Professor Risser said at the very beginning of the show concerning the background of the editors and the writers and the cartoonists of Charlie Hebdo. Not all of them, but a lot of them did grow up professionally in the 1960s and were anti-establishment then and remain so today. So if you look at Charlie Hebdo in the last 15 years, 10, 20 years, even 25 years ago, they go after everybody. They just don't go after Islam. They go after Judaism. They go after Christianity. Some of the cartoons in Charlie Hebdo depicting Jewish rabbis is really, some people would find hilarious, but other people would find to be very offensive. And the same thing about Pope Francis and members of the Catholic religion. And so I think, in a sense, you have to look at Charlie Hebdo as kind of an equal opportunity employer, and I'm not an apologist for it, I'm just making this observation that any target for them is game, and they went after it and enjoyed it. And in that sense, I think they're less like Rolling Stone and more like The Onion in the sense that they're just totally irreverent about everything.
Let's hear from Nicole about that. Nicole Dombrowski-Risser?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I suppose I shouldn't have used this this comparison. I think of Hunter S. Thompson as being completely irreverent and being, you know, part of that early Rolling Stone crowd.
Gonzo journalism.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, these guys had fun, and they wanted to laugh and at anybody's expense. And I think, you know, one of the important things to keep in mind about French cartooning is that this is a special kind of a journal. In Le Monde, there's a very famous cartoonist, more a little bit like Pat Oliphant, right? Plantu. And Plantu has given several interviews saying, you know, I have to get my cartoons approved by my editor. And if I don't argue the point, and if I am really distasteful and the journal is going to lose you know, readers or offend somebody, or, you know, I have to adjust my cartoon and I've got to come back. So this is a different species of lampoon artists. They are completely, no holes barred. And I really rarely agree with David Brooks, but I read his column today where he said, you know, we can say that we aren't, you know, that there's a place in a society for these kinds of guys, for these kinds of cartoonists. And if we start, you know, that it's got to be cultures of taste and cultures of propriety that say, you know, we're not gonna read this stuff, or we're not gonna give it a lot of importance, but this isn't appearing in the daily newspapers of France. And so, you know, the French do have speech regulation, and they do have self-censorship as well. So this is, but do you want to close down possibility of articulating, you know, some ideas that have to be at some point maybe put out there in order for the conversation to move forward?
Fahim? I would slightly disagree with that. I believe a few years ago there was a cartoonist at Charlie Hebdo who was fired for writing something anti-Semitic. So yes, not that I would want them to be equal opportunity, that would not make it right, but there is a clear red line sometimes that a community, that a group, that a religion draws. It's not. You can, you know, you want to mock Islam. Start with Saudi Arabia, go all the way to Pakistan, have no problem. There's a 1.4 point, you know, there are billions of people out there. There's a clear red line that we've drawn around our prophet. We expect that to be respected. Just like the African-American community has drawn a clear red line around the N-word. And I'd love to respect that. Or the homophobic slurs. Or the Holocaust. Those are clear red lines. The problem is somehow this image is given that, you know, we are like the stick in the eye, you know, this is very important, as if you're standing up against some totalitarian regime. No, that's not what it is.
Well, how reflective is it of French society, though, Nicole? French society is not as religious as it used to be.
Well, it's not been religious for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Idea of 2% people who are practicing Christians, for example, and 17% of the society being Muslim and being very, very practicing. I think it's important to realize that this no-holds-barred approach towards religion, and I just saw that in Charlie Hebdo last week, they had the life of Christ as an infant, and it was a complete mockery of Christ's youth, so to speak. Church and state relations in Europe are quite different than here. And I think that that's hard to keep in mind when we have these conversations, because there's called the Ministry of Cults in France, and all religions fall under the Ministry of Cults. None is treated with more esteem than other. Catholicism in 1905 was erased as the official Church of France, and even under the Vichy regime was not, you know, completely rehabilitated as the religion of France. But under the Fifth Republic, the Ministry of Cults deals with these as, you know, just, you know, the witches are the same as the Jews are the same from the government's perspective.
Yeah, I get it. I'm looking at this as conflict then. No, this seems inherent.
Yeah. Well, it's got a long history.
Let's go to Gounet. Gounet, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I had a comment. I'm actually Muslim and I live in the United States. And my main point was basically that I think after an incident like this, it becomes a little frustrating because the perpetrators are only known as a Muslim, but nothing else about their character or personality or background seems to be questioned. And I also do think that in France, it becomes a little bit of a duality when you don't allow women who wear the hijab not to go to university and then wanted to basically protect a democracy that you're putting forth. But that's, it's questionable whose democracy or who's really benefiting from that democracy. And I'll take your answers off.
We'll go to Fahim Yunus.
Fantastic point. You know, I completely agree with her that the first victim of this tragic attack was a Muslim police officer. That story died within minutes because you are only important as a Muslim if you are behind the gun, not if you are in front of the gun, as somebody said at Al Jazeera the other day.
Let's take another call. Joanne in Baltimore, welcome to the show.
Hi, yes. I have Muslims in my family. My sister, my brother-in-law is from the Middle East. So I understand the religion, but I'm tired of hearing about it. Nobody's mentioning that these guys are gangsters and mobsters, and they're just trying to impress other gangsters and mobsters. Much like drug cartel in Mexico.
Yeah.
And they're all playing one against the other to see who can get the most money. And I don't think it has anything to do with free speech. It doesn't have anything to do with Islam. It's just a bunch of gangsters.
Well, how do we know? You know, this takes more research. We're starting to learn more and more about Amedi. Is it Amedi Coulibaly? He's the accomplice, also deceased now, who was at the kosher market. And about the brothers. And I always wonder this, Nicole or Fahim, when we have these conversations, that what are we talking about here? Is this someone truly inspired, self-radicalized, or just someone who has a mental illness, or people, more than one, who have some sort of mental illness, a need to be recognized, a violent nature?
This goes back to the Muslim-American phenomenon, Dan. Once you destabilize an identity, all these people, I can go through the list, they have a clear identity crisis. And in the world of terrorism, they become a swing vote. You know, then they are anyone can capture them. Many of them we capture in the Western society. There are a lot of people who are even turning atheists. But then there is...
Muslims who turn Muslims, atheists?
Absolutely, because they become that destabilized identity crisis where they are a swing vote. Anyone can come and grab them. But when you have laws like blasphemy in your country and you justify them under a religious legal cover and you give sermons and sermons over that...
Yeah.
That is a direct link that I'm trying to break.
Another call. Alan in Long Green. Thank you. We've got a couple of minutes left in the show. Alan, go right ahead.
Okay, Dan, I'll be quick. I just wanted to weigh in on what I hear when I hear discussions of what constitutes terrorism and attempts to draw moral equivalencies between a number of different scenarios. The definition of terrorism is intentional targeting of civilians in order to achieve political or military objectives. And yes, when we have drone attacks in these countries, civilians die, and it's a tragedy. But it is not, we are not targeting those civilians. And I think whenever you draw these and say, you know, you get into this discussion, it's too easy. You know, in the case of the Charlie Hebdo attacks, this is clearly escalating what is a war of ideas. Unless you say that a war of ideas justifies a war of violence and weapons. I mean, I think that's the difference in a civilized society. You can have a war of ideas without it being an absolute war, a life or death war.
Right. Interesting points. Alan, thank you very much for the comment. Any comment on what Alan was saying there?
Well, I think a war on ideas is interesting because the president of France has said we are at war. And what's the implication of that? Because we are at war with ourselves, the French with the French. These are all three men were born in France. These
right.
are French men before they are anything else, and they are seen as French men before the law, which is in part why their stories are tragic. And we talked in the earlier hour, I heard the show about violence in Baltimore, and the story of many of those men who are living a violent life in Baltimore could be very similar to the story of the of these Kouachi brothers, and we shouldn't forget that.
Thank you, Nicole.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. It was nice to have you on the show today. Nice to meet you. Nicole Dombrowski-Risser, who teaches history at Towson University, is a professor there. With scholarship in France and Europe, and the author of France Under Fire, German Invasion, Civilian Flight, and Family Survival During World War II, which was published a couple of years ago by Cambridge University Press. Thank you so much for your input today.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your comments. And as always, Fahim Yunus, nice to have you on the show with
your
perspective as a Muslim American. Fahim Yunus is the Baltimore president of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community and a senior fellow at the Hofburger Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. Thank you for listening, everyone. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you again tomorrow.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman.